This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. The Silver Bullet Security Podcast is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. This is the sixth in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very happy to have with me today Michael Howard. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
So Michael is a senior security program manager at Microsoft, where he's worked since 1992. Michael Howard is not the Prime Minister of Australia. He's very well known for his work in software security, lives in Washington with his wife Cheryl, son Blake, and daughter Paige. And he has a very mysterious past. If you try to Google stuff up on Michael, you won't find much stuff. Although, he's been blogging since 2004, which as far as I can tell is about 18-plus dog years. And you can see his blog, which is very interesting, at blogs.msdn.com/Michael_Howard. So let's get started. What do you say?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Microsoft has done lots to turn their reputation in security around over the last 10 years. And you've been there the whole time. You've seen the whole thing unfold. So my first question is, what's it been like to be on the inside as Microsoft comes to grips with security?
Wow. How long have we got? I mean, you're right. I mean, this is, it's a long, long, long story. It's been fascinating watching the turnaround. It's been fascinating watching the culture change across the company. I mean, it has taken a while, because you can only really make large sort of effectual changes in sort of next major releases of products as opposed to service packs. So we're starting to see the first major products coming out now that have really been touched, you know, to a great degree by the security work that we've done, the security development lifecycle stuff, the SDL. SQL Server 2005 is the first version of SQL Server to be touched by end-to-end by SDL. Windows Vista was the first version of Windows to be completely touched by SDL. We had service packs and so on that were touched by parts of SDL, but there's only so much you can do in a service pack. You can only do sort of tactical things as opposed to strategic things. But to answer your question more directly, it's been kind of amazing actually watching the change and watching the way people think change. To give you an example, it's an example I've often cited, but you get an email from someone saying, what do you think of this code? What do you think of this design? What's the most secure way of doing blah, blah, blah?
Right.
And my response was always the same. I have no clue. Until I know the threats that worry you or the threats that are of concern, then I really can't help you out. So now, everyone's sort of swung around to thinking about security as in threats. Mm-hmm. And now I get email from people saying, what's the most secure way of doing blah, taking into consideration these threats and these limiting factors or things we have to worry about.
So there's more sophisticated thinking about security now.
Yeah, and a lot of it's more up, and the vast majority of it now is up front as opposed to, oh my God, we're about to ship, help us secure the product.
Check this box and pretend it's secure.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't see any of that anymore. I'm not going to say that this is perfect. It's not perfect at all, but the progress to date over the last few years has been, I think, pretty stacked. For those who want to look at the stats, the results, I think, are pretty staggering, but we still have a lot of work to do.
So in 1992, when you first started working at Microsoft, what were you doing?
I was working in product support on, believe it or not, I was working on Windows, and I was doing developer support for our C compilers. Mm-hmm. And, back then, Windows was a single-user operating system. The internet wasn't anything around that anyone knew about. Mm-hmm. And I have no doubt that many people had many, many buffer overruns in their C code. But it kind of didn't matter because the stuff wasn't networked, and there was no notion of elevation of privilege.
Right.
But things have changed dramatically.
Yeah, they really have. I mean, you've also seen a pretty radical shift in the thinking coming from the executive suite. And one of the things I wonder is, how much of a hand did you play in that? Was it sort of unfolding naturally? How did that all come to pass?
Actually, that's such an important point. I don't think we could have gotten the traction that we have and seeing the results that we've seen, if it wasn't for the fact we got Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer completely bought off on this. And so we recognize, our group really started as a grassroots effort, working with individual product groups and
when was
individual
that?
Developers.
What year was that?
I'm sorry?
What year was that you started doing that?
99?
Yeah, it was
2000-ish.
Jason?
Yeah. So, and we made some progress. We found some bugs. Some bugs got fixed. But until you actually make it part of the culture, you really can't make a lot of progress.
Yeah,
and most importantly, you've got to get the execs bought off on this. And so a bunch of things actually happened all around the same time. Code Red had happened. Nimdra had happened. David LeBlanc and I had just released Writing Secure Code,
mm-hmm.
and Bill loved the book, and Craig Mundy had been working on this thing called, that had no name at the time, but ended up being known as Trustworthy Computing. So we had kind of this syzygy, all the planets all aligned, all around, just after Code Red and NIMDA and so on, like end of 2001,
mm-hmm.
early 2002, and then we had the famed Windows security push in January. January, February, March of 2002, Trustworthy Computing Memo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So everything all sort of aligned all at the same time. And having the executive commitment from Bill and Steve is just paramount, because you're affecting entire products here.
Yeah, we've seen that as critical in our customers at Sigil as well, where if you don't have buy-in from the top, it just, it hits a wall, or it seems like kind of a grassroots geek thing that doesn't really trickle up into existence.
Yeah, and I think that one of the biggest mistakes that I've seen many security people do, or one of the mistakes they make, is they treat it as this geeky, oh my goodness, the sky is falling thing.
Right.
And the execs, I found, regardless of company, don't really like that.
Well, when you run a business, you find out the sky is falling every day.
Exactly.
You just got to deal with it.
Yeah. So, one thing that we've done is really focused on not just... Within Microsoft, it's fairly straightforward. We can focus on the security aspects. But I think for a lot of companies, they can't, who are not software vendors, because security is like this nebulous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you can sell it in terms of privacy and reliability... The reliability guys at Microsoft, especially in Windows, I mean, they love us, because every time a security issue is removed, then that's another potential reliability issue.
Absolutely,
gone as well.
So
running to the execs with the sky's falling doesn't really work very well. But going with more tangible things like privacy and reliability and sort of means a lot to execs.
Mm-hmm. Software security is a relatively new field, and to some extent, we're busy inventing it. So outside of Microsoft, how do you feel about progress in the field as a whole?
Define the field.
The field of software security, teaching people who build stuff how to build things properly, the sorts of activities they ought to do, kind of what you guys have been bringing to life in the Trustworthy Computing Initiative.
This is going to sound really, really cynical. I have yet to see a lot of people admit there is a problem. I still do not see people saying, we have a security problem and we need to fix it.
Right.
And until we get over that hump, you can have all the best research and all the best tools and all the smartest people on the planet. But until someone actually stands up and says, oh my goodness, we've got a problem we need to solve, what's the point?
So I'm a little more optimistic than you are on that front, because I think people are becoming aware of the problem. They all aren't convinced. But, 10 years ago, think about the difference. You could say software security and people would look at you and say, what are you talking about?
Right.
And now you say software security and they go, oh yeah, that's important, but I'm not sure how to do it. That's kind of my perception.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to continue with my cynical thing.
That's fine.
I agree with you that the progress over the last 10 years has been progress,
uh-huh.
but has the progress actually kept pace with the threats? And I think the answer is no.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
We're making progress, and let's just I don't know, let's put some absolutely arbitrary numbers here and say that, you know, 10 years ago we were at level 1 and now we're at level, you know, the industry as a whole is at level 5.
Yeah.
But the threats 10 years ago were 1, but now the threats are like 1,000.
Right.
So yeah, there's been progress, but I really do not believe many vendors, software developers are actually keeping track and trying to keep up with the existing and constantly evolving threat landscape. And that's
I think you're right about that. I mean, you guys are stick out like crazy among software vendors. There are others that are in different industries that might be catching on more, but that's because they're used to thinking about threats and risks a little more than software people are.
Yeah, yep. That I would agree with, yeah.
But I'd say that you guys are definitely leading the pack in among software vendors, and you're so far ahead it's kind of scary. So
scary.
Well, yeah, because, you know, if you guys are playing catch-up, think about the poor other guys that are really playing catch-up.
That's a fair comment.
They haven't even started yet.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why we focus, like in Windows Vista, you know, so much on not just trying to get the code right, but it's also recognizing that we're never going to get the code 100% correct, ever, you know, because we're human beings. And the one thing that sort of sets security apart from so many other aspects of software engineering is that security is man versus man.
Right.
This is not man versus machine.
Yeah, it's
you can solve performance problems.
Yep, yep.
You can solve performance problems, right, because this is a computer you're dealing with.
Right.
But security is really different because you're never going to get things 100% correct because the adversary is very, very clever.
Yep.
And is always thinking up new attacks. So one thing we've done in Windows Vista is we spent a lot of time working on the code, but that's why we have so many defenses in the OS as well, recognizing that we're never going to get things 100% correct. And if we can help reduce the severity of vulnerabilities, or perhaps a vulnerability can't be taken advantage of because of a defense, then that's great.
Yeah, that's very good. So that's using the principle of defense in depth, really.
Yeah, and we've actually been a little bit more creative in that area. I mean, I think defense in depth is really sort of an umbrella term for a lot of other things like resiliency and isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Like how can you isolate the potential damage? So yeah, defense in depth I think is a good umbrella, but we've sort of got a few subcategories underneath there, and one of them is like isolation, is isolating the potential damage in the system.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, compartmentalization is another great principle. So
exactly.
That's one of the things I really like about the stuff in writing secure code is the coverage of the principles, which I think is really, really important, and something that we're probably going to have a tendency to lose when it comes to thinking about software security if we just degenerate to the bug parade, you know.
Exactly, and I think this is one of the things that you brought up many, many times is I think a lot of people have lost track of design,
yeah.
And a lot of people are focusing on just the bug parade, like just fixing bugs and fixing coding issues,
yep.
Which, you know, is... I mean, I think getting the code right is absolutely the correct thing to do, but my goodness, you can't lose track of the designs either. And I think the industry as a whole has gravitated around just pure coding issues.
Probably because it's easier, you know, it's low hanging fruit, so you do the easy stuff first.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and let's be honest. I mean, if you've got a bad design, it's probably going to be hard to fix that design, you know, because it's the design, for crying out loud.
That's right. So you address that in your new book called The Security Development Lifecycle.
Right.
You guys describe a process called the SDL, the Security Development
yep.
Lifecycle, that you're instituting at Microsoft. And so one question is, how's that rollout going, especially in light of the fact that, you know, the best coders that I know are just completely and utterly allergic to process.
Right. So I'll be honest with you, the SDL evolved. I mean, there was never a single point in time where we can say, you know, one day we didn't do SDL, next day we did. We were really kind of feeling our way through and finding out, you know, which things worked, which things didn't work, and so on. And then we added those to the SDL.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the critical thing about the SDL is we really had two options. Option number one is rip out the existing processes at Microsoft and replace them with something completely, utterly brand new.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. But it was an option, right? And I'll be frank, if we did that, we'd still be sitting around a table. This podcast would be, Michael, when are you guys like going to start fixing security bugs? Because there's no way. I mean, instigating a brand new process is a lot of work, I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
The other option is to take the existing process at Microsoft and augment it with deliverables and requirements and best practice and policy, mm-hmm. and try to be a little less invasive. And that's what we ended up doing. And we've seen a lot of benefit from doing that. So the actual process changes that we made are actually fairly subtle. They're not. It's not like we completely overhauled everything to have a brand new process, because at the end of the day, we have to ship software.
Yeah, sure.
And so the SDL is really just augmenting the existing process.
Yeah. So the real question is, in a lot of large organizations, they have a process, but people just kind of do what they do, and
right.
they produce lots of code. Maybe you guys were slightly more rigorous at Microsoft than some other situations that I've seen. But still, how do you go to somebody who's really a hardcore code guy, a software person, and get them to embrace process at all?
It's funny, because at Microsoft, it's like if you want to be involved in the Microsoft salary participation program, well, you gotta do this stuff.
Oh, that's good. That's a great way to do it. Yeah,
it's part of your job. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Well, it's like reviewing old code, right? I mean, people hate reviewing code. What would you rather do? Would you rather review some code that was like 15 years old, where
right.
the last guy who touched it is now working on Xbox, or write some new funky shell code? Well, at Microsoft, we can make it part of your job. You've got to review 100,000 lines of that crusty old code.
Right.
This coming year is part of your job.
Right.
So, I think that's actually an advantage that we do have, is that we can actually put these policies in place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, the reaction we've had around here from developers has actually been very, very positive. We actually thought that words like mandatory and policy would just scare people away.
Right.
But it turns out, and LeBlanc has said this many, many times, for every developer he's ever dealt with, they've always wanted to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Always. And they have no problem doing the right thing. The critical thing is you have to show them what the right thing is.
Oh, that's interesting.
And once you show them, and more importantly, you don't show them what it is, but you show them how they can measure it and show that they're being successful at what they're doing, they'll do it in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Which we never expected.
But you found out that that's true.
But it's actually true, yeah.
So there are a lot of best practices that people have identified, and I have some in my work, and you guys have a bunch in the SDL.
Yeah, you call them touch points, right?
I call them touch points, yeah.
Yep.
But in your mind, what are the top two things that, let's say that you have a software process and you're sort of kind of following it and you got to get started with software security, what are the two most important best practices?
If I had to just two, and I really don't like doing that, but I'll humor you. The two would probably be awareness and education would be number one.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about that is that's relatively low-hanging fruit.
Right.
So one thing that we do at Microsoft is we have well north of a dozen different classes that we have. And engineers must go through these classes, go through at least one class every year.
Right.
And we track that. We track that to the individuals.
Yep.
And in fact, any manager can see how compliant his team is, which is actually kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. That's one of the reasons why in the SDL book on the CD on the back, we included a recording of the security basics class that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
Is like, in our opinion, everyone should have like a baseline knowledge. I would say that would be number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I think, will be just understanding the threats to the software.
Mm-hmm.
Once you understand the threats to the software, you can get a better idea about how well you have mitigated those threats or not. There are features at Microsoft that never made it into Windows Vista because of the threat models.
Right.
Let me give you a really good example. There was a feature that was going to go into Vista. It was Longhorn back then. The guys did the threat models. They looked at the threat models and it was like, the number one user of our feature is going to be the bad guys, which is never a good thing.
Right.
So they asked for a 2-hour meeting with me to go through their threat models. So, sure. So I went through the threat models. The meeting lasted 7 minutes.
Right.
I looked at the threat models. I'm like, yeah, guys, you're
right. Don't do it.
You're right. But I thought, no, let's see if there's any mitigations we can put in place.
Oh, no.
So we looked at that. So there were some mitigations, but the problem is the feature is now completely unusable.
Right.
So you've got two options. Ship something that's usable by the bad guys, or ship something that's totally unusable by the users.
Mm-hmm.
So that we ended up pulling the third option. That feature was never built.
Right, so it's always that trade-off that you have to go through.
And if I had to, if you gave me the third one would be teach the developers to always understand what the bad guy controls.
Yeah, that's good.
That is so important when it comes to code review, when it comes to threat modeling. Like, where did this data come from? Is it an anonymous remote user? You know, oops, that could be bad. You know, if you've got, you know, code that's listening on anonymous remote connections, is it local admin only? At what point in the code is the data sanitized? Like, we found about a year ago, we found a buffer overrun that had been introduced into Windows Vista. Now, when we looked at the code, it's like, yeah, it's a buffer overrun. The guide allocated a three-element array and then wrote at element number three a null character,
mm-hmm.
which is actually the fourth element.
Right.
Now,
because C is such a great language, you can do things like that.
Hey, I like C. But it was a buffer overrun, but the bad guy controlled nothing, right? The bad guy didn't control the null and didn't control the element.
So you might have a seg fault, and that's about it.
Well, actually, it turned out there was actually some slack after that buffer, so there was no seg fault or AV. But there could have been, absolutely. It was a coding bug, absolutely, but it wasn't a security bug.
Right.
Because the bad guy controlled zip.
So now I have another quick question, which is, what is the dumbest security bug that you wrote yourself before you found the religion that is software security?
Oh, I can answer that question easily. I wrote a whole bunch of SQL code 1,000 years ago.
In the Pleistocene?
That's exactly right, when I was still dragging my knuckles. And it was actually for an insurance company. The only saving grace here, it was purely internal, but I wouldn't say that was too much of a saving grace. But I actually had SQL injection attacks.
Right.
I was calling stored procedures. I kind of sort of knew about SQL injection issues, but not really the subtleties of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was calling stored procedures, thinking that the problems would just go away. It turns out that's actually not true for some classes of SQL injection attack. Mm-hmm. So the worst thing about that is, you know, that SQL injection attacks are kind of bad, you know. You can compromise entire networks through SQL injection attacks.
Isn't it funny to go back and see how far we've come, even our own selves?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then a non-technical question for you to kind of wrap things up. What books are you currently reading?
What books am I currently reading? My goodness. So I actually read about 9 books at once.
Oh, there you go. So what 9 books are you reading?
So I'm actually reading one on, it's on my shelf right now. There's a couple of books I'm always referring to. One is Mastering Regular Expressions from O'Reilly.
Uh-huh.
I'm always referring to that. I refer to it all the time. Actually, another book I always have on my bookshelf ready to read in arm's length is Bishop's Computer Security.
Yeah.
I actually think if I was stranded on a desert island, I would actually, that would be the book I would have.
Wow. You're crazy.
Yeah, I know.
A technical book?
Yeah.
So what non-technical books are you reading right now?
You know, I'm going to be, the book I'm reading right now, I'll be honest with you, I've actually forgotten the title, but it's all about the education system in the U.S.
Oh, interesting.
Because Blake has just turned 5 and is about to enter kindergarten. I thought it may be worthwhile me understanding the education system.
Where did you go through school?
It was in New Zealand.
In New Zealand?
Yeah, I did geology.
Huh.
Almost as, I've got a similar background to you.
Nothing well, yeah, philosophy is actually slightly less lucrative than geography, I bet.
Yeah.
So the New Zealand system, school system in for kids must be a lot different than the American school system.
Yeah. It is. I think it's a little bit more laid back.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably the big one.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But
yeah.
But it certainly turns out good. Auckland University turns out good geologists.
Well, I was thinking more about Blake than you.
I wouldn't have a clue. I would have no idea about kindergarten. I mean, my brother's putting his kids through, but I have no clue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks a lot for your time. It's been really fun.
Hey, pleasure's all mine. Thank you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Responsibility Security and Privacy magazine. To subscribe, you can go today to www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.